College Farm, Georgia.
Thank you, I needed that. My home group is the Monday Fairburn Group. We meet Monday nights at 8 o'clock. If you're ever in Fairburn, please come visit us. This is great. It's really nice. This is too many people for Friday night. I want to thank the committee for inviting me here. It's always a privilege and an honor to be asked to come and share your experience, strength, and hope. And I try to do that whenever I can, because this is one way that I can try to give back to the program what was so kindly given to me. People like you shared with me how this program works, and that's why I'm here today. So I try to do that whenever I can. I want to thank Pete for staying in touch with me, and she probably did tell me that I was speaking tonight, and I'm an old woman. My birthday was this month, and I am celebrating the 21st anniversary of my 21st birthday. So I suffer from Alzheimer's, senility, and chronic CRS. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's can't remember and you feel like the rest. Sometimes it's in remission and sometimes it's not. And today I think it was working full bloom. I want to thank Sharon, too, because she was very instrumental in getting me here, and I have a few words for her, too. She gave me directions on how to get here. And what she told me to do was, after I got on 79 to get to 33, that I was going to see a sign that says Jackson Mill Road, and right at that sign there was going to be a hotel. And she gave me the name of the hotel. The hotel has no name on it. I passed it. And then she said, when I got on Jackson Mill, I passed a golf course. And shortly thereafter the golf course, I see a little bridge that went over a very little river. I saw the golf course. Now, I don't know what you call a short term after, but it was not a short term after. And then she said when we got to the campus that we would see a private airstrip. God meant for me to be here. I need to get busy and do what I was asked to do, and I am very nervous because it's kind of hard to get here at 6 o'clock, oh no, 6:30, 6:30, 6, well, excuse me, 6:30, I was fudging it a little, and get a shower, get dressed, get unpacked, and get here, and I am very nervous right now. So what I always try to do before I share anything with you is get self out of the way and invite the God of my understanding in to talk for me. And I ask you to help me invite the God of my understanding in. So if you'll just take a moment of silence, we'll get started. Amen. I was born, contrary to popular opinion, to two beautiful people, my mom and dad, and that was many, many years ago. As far as I know, my parents were not alcoholics. My mother and dad drank and they entertained and they had parties and they went to parties. But I never saw my parents drunk. I never saw them argue with one another. So I can't really say that I grew up in an alcoholic home. I don't think I did. I do have relatives that qualify for the program. But they didn't live with us. But I was an only child until about the age of 5 years old, and then my mom and dad decided they wanted a well-rounded family, so they had my brother. It took me about 4 years in this program to forgive my mother for that. You see, my brother's a very, very special young man in my life today. He was not always so. he was the only child, only male child in our family on both sides. And so that made him special all by itself, because he was the one that was going to carry on the family's name. And I think I felt out of place in my own family, because I felt like he was treated differently from me by all of our family members. So I didn't feel like I belonged even in my own family. It was nothing that my mom and dad did specifically. It was nothing that they said. There were no actions that I can really tell you that were taken that made me feel this way. I just felt out of place. I got it into my head some kind of way that I didn't belong. And I lived on that, and I worked off of that, and I survived from that. My parents, like I said, are very loving. They always tried to make us feel like we were special, like we could do anything we wanted to do and be anyone we wanted to be. We had the abilities and the wisdom to achieve. But I didn't hear those things growing up. I didn't feel that way growing up. I felt like, yeah, they had to say things like that, because what parent wants to own up to a dorky kid? So of course they're going to tell me that I'm pretty and I'm smart and I can do all these things, because, you know, what else do you tell us? So I had this preconception of myself that caused me a lot of trouble, and I didn't realize that until I got here. What I'm going to try to share with you this afternoon are three major character defects in my life that still plague me today. I have a lot, but these are the three main ones. One of them I call chameleonism. I think in our fellowship it's called people pleasing. I have the ability to change into anybody you want me to be, given the right amount of time, the right set of circumstances. Just give me prior notice and I can be whatever you want me to be. I had some relatives that moved to New York one time, and they lived up there for a few years, and of course they picked up the accent of New Yorkers very fast and so forth. And at the age of 12, my parents and I went up there to visit them, and within about 15 minutes, I talked like a New Yorker. I used to share in my talks that I was afraid that one of these days God was going to put me in a position where I'd be around people like Japanese, and I'd be afraid what would happen to me then. I don't know about you, but the God of my understanding has a very sick sense of humor, and I did get to go to the International in San Diego, which was absolutely fantastic, and I was around people who spoke several different languages, and I prayed the whole time. Thank God this program works. The other character defect that I have that I'd like to share about in my talk is, I don't know about you, but reality scares the devil out of me. I don't care too much for reality, for real life. I love fairy tales. I love fantasy land. I can create a world that I can live in and be comfortable in. And I did that for a very long time until I got to you. And the other one is I have a problem with being committed to anything. In school, I wasn't a bad student. I was an average student. Subjects that came real easy to me, I made A's in, and I excelled in them. And the subjects that I had to put a little elbow grease to and work with, I usually, I try them. But I always had an excuse and an escape for when I failed. It was always somebody else's fault. I always pointed that finger to the teacher or to the classmate or to something that interfered with me achieving. So I had a lot of trouble committing to anything, because I was afraid that if I did not succeed, you wouldn't like me, I wouldn't have any place to be, or some drastic thing would happen to me if I did not succeed in whatever I tried. So I tried to try very little, if that makes sense. I told you about my chameleonism. The first recollections of this, I was, I guess, about 7 or 8 years old. I had a girl cousin to come spend the night with me, and my brother, who was a toddler at that time, hated to sleep by himself. He hated it. He was afraid to sleep by himself, and we slept in separate bedrooms. And this one particular night, he crawled out of his bed and came in to ask me if he could sleep with me, which was what he did every night.
And I didn't mind that very much because it gave me a purpose. It made me feel like somebody in my family needed me. So I didn't mind that very much. Well, this particular night he came into the bedroom and he was about to ask me if he could crawl in bed with me. And this girl cousin called my mom into the room and told her that he was out of his bed, and mom came in and spanked him and sent him back to his room, and he was crying. Now, my insides was very, very upset with this. I did not like to see my brother hurt. I did not like the idea that he couldn't sleep with me. I didn't like the idea that he had to go back into his room, which he was very afraid of, and sleep by himself. However, this girl cousin of mine thought it was very funny that my brother got in trouble, and she started laughing about it and joking about it. I don't know about you, but when you're a people pleaser to the first degree, you forget about self and you take on whatever's around you, and I did just that. I denied the feelings that were inside of me. I denied that I hurt for my brother and that I didn't like the situation he was in. But I wanted this cousin to like me, and I want her to accept me, and I wanted to be a part of her life. Therefore, I laughed too. That was not how I felt, but that's what I did. And I continued to perform like that, and I do mean it was a performance until I got to you. My mom, I'm going to share a little bit with you about my mom. I put my mother up on a pedestal. I caused a lot of situations in my life that I was not aware of until I got into this program. My mother is she's my best friend today. She really is. I can remember her telling me as a kid that we weren't meant to be best friends, that as long as I was as old as I was and she was as old as she was, that we would always be mother and daughter and there'd be nothing in between. That's not true. My mom and I are very close friends today. But I put her up on this pedestal because mother, she's a classy lady. When she walks into the room, you know you're in the presence of a lady. And I wanted to be just like her. My mother is very studious. She loves knowledge. She loves learning. She just loves to read, and she just consumes books and things. And I wanted to be like her. But I'm not like her. I'm the class clown. I'm not the one that gets in trouble, but I like being around people. I like entertaining people. I like making people laugh. And sometimes at my own expense, but at that point in time, I didn't care. I felt like if I could make you laugh, you'd want to keep me around. So I felt like a failure in my mother's eyes. She never said that. Again, this was my interpretation of how she felt. I wanted so much to be like her, and I felt like I disappointed her because I was not just like her. And when I had problems and things that bothered me and things that I needed to talk over with my mom, I never went to her because I felt like if I went to her and told her these things, it would just further confirm that I was not the daughter she thought I was supposed to be, that I was a failure in her eyes. So therefore, I had to carry a lot of things inside of me for a lot of years by myself. I was an average student in school. To please my mother, I was always on the honor roll in the upper 10% of my class. I was always outgoing. I was in all kinds of clubs at school because I needed to be around you. I needed to feel like I had a purpose. I needed to be accepted and loved. And I didn't care who gave it to me. I just had to have it. I met my husband in high school. We had varying stories until when we first came in the program and started sharing. I thought I met him in one place, and he said, no, I met you at another place, and we decided he was right. as the story goes, I met him in a counselor's office at school, in high school, and I don't remember exactly why we were there. I figured that I was there because I was trying to better myself. And I figured he was there because he was in trouble as usual. But anyway, I had on a shirt dress that had a tie belt around it. And somehow or another, JC got that belt off of me. And he said, if you want this, follow me. We laugh about that today. Because had I known then what I know now, and had he known then what he knows now, I don't think he would have taken the belt. And if he was just crazy enough to take it, I think I would have let him have it. But, like I said, the God of my understanding has a very sick sense of humor and decided we deserved each other. And we met, dated, fought, and got married. We went into my parents on a Friday afternoon and said, we're getting married tonight at 8 o'clock, be there or not. My mother didn't like that real well. She told me if I didn't marry this man, she would, and finish college, because I was in college when we decided to get married, that she would buy me a brand new car and send me to Europe. In case I have any problems with insanity, this deal seals it for me. I took an alcoholic over Europe and a new car. I wish I could retract that. Oh, well. My husband and I did get married that night, and this is where Fantasyland comes into play. This man, when we met, paid attention to me. He made me feel like I was the center of his world. He made me feel like I was the apple in his eye. And I just knew that I had found my one true love, and I wasn't going to let go. We got married that Friday night, and I'm going to share a little bit about the honeymoon, but not the good parts, so don't get too comfortable. My husband and I were very young when we got married, and we had never been married before, and we'd never lived with anyone before, slept with anyone before. So, and we lived, when we got married, we moved into his mom's house. Now, his mother was a single parent with 7 children. And we were tired for the night, and I knew nothing about my husband's sleeping habits. So we slept in a full-size bed. My husband is 6 feet tall. At that time, he was 185 pounds. I was about 90 pounds, sopping wet. And he rolled over, and I rolled out. Now, as I told you, I love fairy tales, and this was my fairy tale. This was my Prince Charming. He was going to carry me off into the sunset on his beautiful white charger, and we were going to live happily ever after. So I'm on the floor waiting on this man to realize that his wife of a few hours is missing. I'm the apple of his eye. You know, he's supposed to know these things. He never broke a snore. I have never professed to be, nor will I probably ever profess to be normal. A normal person will get up, wake the partner up and say, scoot over. Or if you don't feel like being polite, shove him over and get in. I'm not normal. I sat on the floor waiting for him to realize that there was something missing in his life. And when he didn't realize that, I began to wake him up in a very loving manner, and that was by beating him with a pillow and demanding a divorce. Somewhere in the course of the night, the phone got ripped out of the wall, and this is the way our marriage began. And it got worse. Our children came immediately afterwards. I knew nothing about alcoholism. I was completely ignorant to alcoholism. Again, fantasy land. My concept of an alcoholic was a Skid Row bum. That guy you see in those major towns that walks up and down the street in grungy old clothes that he's probably worn for months and months and months on end. He's got bottles, hopefully with something in them, all over him, most times not. He smells of all kinds of odors. He sleeps on the street, under the bridge, wherever he can find a spot. You know, this was my concept of an alcoholic. My husband didn't fit that. He didn't fit that bill. We entertained, just like my mom and dad. My husband did drink. We went to parties. We had parties in our home. But I never realized that alcoholism was a problem. I thought it was me. I went from being the apple of his eyes to the pain in his you-know-what very quickly. I tried to please this man in every way possible. I don't advise this for those of you who happen to be newlyweds or thinking of getting married. There are some things my mother told me that I didn't heed to, and I'm going to share with you. Don't start anything that you don't want to do the rest of your life. I fed this man breakfast, lunch, and dinner in bed. I don't do that anymore. He's not happy about that part of recovery. I dressed up real sexy. He wasn't interested. I'd walk around the house looking like a slob. He'd say, "Why don't you fix yourself up?" I cook a big meal. He's not hungry. I don't cook. He goes, "Where's the food? I'm starving." I did not know what I was dealing with. We go to parties, he'd be the life of the party, he'd have a blast. The minute the party was over and we were alone, we fought. I thought it was me. I didn't know what to do. And I needed his approval. I needed anybody's approval. When I first came into this program, and I attended a lot of meetings because that's what I was told to do, for about 2 years in the program, I never heard anyone talk about physical abuse. I heard you talk about mental abuse. I heard you talk about spiritual abuse. I heard you talk about verbal abuse. I never heard anyone share about physical abuse. I lived in physical abuse. That's not what I was brought up with. Had you asked me before I married this man if I would accept that type of behavior, I would have told you no. But that's not the way it came down. When my husband drank, he became very angry and very mean. And many times I'd have to leave my house with my kids as quickly as possible to keep from being hurt any further. But to tell you where alcoholism took me, yes, my husband was violent, he was abusive, but the insanity hit me also. There were times when I could see a fight coming that I wouldn't give him the opportunity to hurt me. I hurt myself. I take my fist, I beat myself about the head until I almost knock myself unconscious. I'd run myself into a wall. I attempted suicide a few times. So alcoholism doesn't just affect the alcoholic, it truly affects those who love them. And had it not been for Al-Anon, I would not be standing here before you today. The choices I made trying to find acceptance and love nearly cost me my life. I needed so badly to be accepted by someone, anyone, I didn't care who it was, that I put myself in some very bad situations. I made some very bad choices. I hurt a lot of people, including myself, trying to fit in, trying to be a part of, trying to find that love that makes us whole. I'm not proud of the choices I made. But I'm very grateful that the God of my understanding gave me a second chance so that I can share with you that there is hope. No matter how far down you think you've gone, there is always hope. I didn't care who paid attention to me. I didn't care what the circumstances would be. I didn't care what price I had to pay. I needed you. And I came as close to prostitution as I ever care to come. In fact, if you really want to be honest about it, I prostituted myself to anyone in the sense that I gave me to you. I allowed you to make my decisions. I allowed you to tell me what to do, how to think, when to think, where to go, where not to go. I turned my will and my life over to you. And I didn't care what you did with me. The straw that broke the camel's back found me lying on the floor with hands around my throat, strangling me. And I had tried to break free and I couldn't get free. And I passed out. I knew that I was dead because I could not physically break free, and I passed out. But I guess the God of my understanding didn't have my room ready for me yet, and I was able to break free. And I found myself in a battered woman's shelter, not knowing where to go, what to do, who to turn to. I need to back up a little bit because I need to share with you about my mother-in-law. This lady was my mother. She's a very earthy lady. And I loved her with all my heart and soul. She listened to me about anything and everything. She didn't judge me. She treated me as if I was one of her own. In fact, many times when my husband and I got into an argument, she would take my side over his. She was my mother for a long time. Well, after I left that battered woman's shelter, my husband and I had a nice long talk, and we decided that the best thing for me was to be committed. I was crazy. So we went out to this place. We got a reference out to this place called Bronner's in Atlanta. And we went into this counselor's office, and my husband began to explain to this counselor me. He told her all about me, everything I'd ever done, everything I'd ever thought about doing, even before birth. He gave her a blow-by-blow description of how I was screwing up his life and everyone's life that I touched. And I sat there in that office and I didn't say a word. I kept my head down and I didn't rebut him because he was telling the truth. He wasn't lying. Everything he said was the truth. And when he got through talking, the counselor looked at me and then she looked at him. And then she looked at me and then she looked back at him. And she said, "Mr. Hall, I think we need to put you in the hospital." If you ever want to get somebody committed, keep your mouth shut, let them talk, they'll walk themselves right on through the door. I can laugh about that today. It is real funny, it is. My husband didn't like that turnout at all. And I'll share that in a second. But when I got to that stage in my life, when I had accepted the fact that there was something truly wrong with me and that I needed help, I had already surrendered. And I was ready to go in that institution. Can you imagine what little self-esteem and self-respect, what happens to it when you've decided you need help and you're not even worthy? You're not even considered? One more time, the alcoholic takes the stage. Can you imagine what that does to a person? Well, I truly felt like nothing. I truly felt like nobody cared if I lived or died. Now, like I said, JC wasn't real happy with that situation. He didn't like the way that turned out. So he talked the counselor into letting him go home to get a toothbrush and some pajamas. And we went bowling and he got drunk. And we went to my mom's house, and he told my mom what had happened. And You know, I find no significance in this, but apparently it was very significant for my husband. My mother, after she sat there listening to him rant and rave for a few minutes, yelled at him, "I can't help you, JC, I can't help you." That's all she said. But from that simple phrase, my husband stopped and decided to go into Bronner's. And we did go home and get him some clothes, and he did go to Bronner's. Now, he did not go to Bronner's for alcoholism. He was diagnosed as being stressed. I didn't like the way things turned out either, because as I told you, my husband didn't fit my idea of what an alcoholic was. Even in his drunken state, he took care of me and the kids. He took care of the bills. He made sure we had a roof over our heads. You know, he was a functioning drunk. And when he went into Bronner's, I had to deal with life on life's terms, and I didn't like that. I tried to get him kicked out of Bronner's, but that didn't work. Now, the part of the story I'm going to share with you right now is the part that I have the most difficulty with even today. I told you about my mother-in-law and how I felt about her. If there was a way to personify the principles of AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen, she would have been it. Because this woman truly loved people unconditionally. If she saw you on the street and you looked like you were hungry, hadn't had a decent meal in a while, and she only had a crust of bread at home, it was no big deal for her to invite you in her home and share what little she had with you. If she saw you on the street and you were cold with no coat, she'd take the coat off her back and give it to you. That's just the type of person she was. She was a giver. She was a giver of herself. And I loved her with all my heart and soul. She was the only person that I could turn to no matter what. While my husband was in Bronner's, this beautiful lady suffered a massive heart attack. And at the age of 54 years old, the God of my understanding took her home. I got a phone call at work, and I was told to get down to the hospital as quickly as possible. My husband was in the treatment center, and I knew what was happening. I prayed to God. I bargained with him. I cursed him. Because I felt like, you know, I'm the one screwing up here. I'm the one that's causing people pain. I'm the one that's hurting people. This lady has done nothing but show love and kindness to whomever crossed her path. God, don't take her. God, she's all I got. I didn't have you. I didn't have this program. I had no one. And by the time I got to the hospital, my mother-in-law was gone. And I was alone. I felt abandoned. I felt abused. I felt rejected. I felt so unloved and so unworthy. If sheer will could have raised that woman from the dead, she'd be standing right here, because when I went into her room, I tried my best to raise her. I told her, "Get up. You can't leave me." I still miss her today. I still miss her today. My husband was the eldest of these seven kids, and the responsibility fell on us to prepare for her funeral. And he had me pick out her coffin. He had me pick out her last dress. The hardest thing in the world I ever had to do. And when they put her in the ground, they might as well have put me in there with her, because there was nothing left for me to live for. Nothing. And my world ended. I didn't care anymore. Well, I guess my husband realized that something was not going to work with this. And I guess Bronner's realized that maybe I needed some help too, so I got myself committed, finally. I went into Bronner's, and they decided I wasn't sick enough, and they kicked me out. They've never heard my story. I ought to take it to them. My husband did go into one more hospital after that one. He went to PIA, Psychiatric Institute of Atlanta. And again, it was for stress, and he was suicidal and homicidal. Oh, and I forgot to tell you, my husband's occupation is a policeman. It's not a real good idea to be homicidal and suicidal with a gun. So they gave him an option of going back into the hospital or losing his job. He went to PIA, and it was there that he met a man that talked to him what we call the language of the heart. As far as we know, this man has been around the program at that time for about 12 years and had never put a year of sobriety together. But God used him that day, and he talked to my husband about alcoholism, and my husband heard the message. And within a few days, my husband called me up, and he said, I want you to come down here to this hospital. I want you to meet some people. I want you to see this film. And I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what was going on. And I went down there, and I went to my very first AA meeting. I don't know how you felt when you first stepped into the doors of these rooms, but I felt love and acceptance. I didn't know you, and I knew you didn't know me except for what JC probably told you. And you put your arms around me, and you greeted me, and you told me you loved me, and to keep coming back. And I felt it. And I was going to do everything in my power to obey that, keep coming back. My husband got a sponsor while he was in the treatment center, and be very careful when a so-called sober 12 years alcoholic gets with a newly sobering alcoholic and starts thinking. You know, my husband did accept the fact that maybe he had a drinking problem and maybe AA worked, but in the back of his mind, he felt like if he could get me straightened out, he could go back to drinking. So they decided I should join AA. The only requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous is a desire to stop drinking. I'm going to give you my drunkalogue. Please don't blink, sneeze, turn, move. You will miss it. I don't know how long we've been married, but we were having one of our usual discussions, loud discussions, and I decided I was going to get even with my husband. I was going to drink up all his beers, and at the time, he had a case of Pony beers in the refrigerator, and I can never remember how many. I think it's, 6 ounces in Pony beers? About 6 ounces? Seven? I can always depend on an alcoholic to tell me that. To me, it's just enough to piss an alcoholic off, not to do any damage. But I decided I was going to drink these up, and I went in, and I popped the can, and I drank half of one. Half of one. And passed out on the bedroom. My husband came in, he said, what's wrong with you? I said, I think I'm drunk. He picked up the can, and it was half full, or empty, whichever way you want to look at it. He said, no way. Okay, a few more years skip along, and we decided we wanted to celebrate our wedding anniversary by having a second honeymoon. Not that the first one was that great. We thought we'd try it again. And my husband was working at this hotel chain, for this chain of hotels, for security. So they gave us a room in their hotel, gave us a magnum of champagne. We went out dancing, and we went to dinner, and then we went back to the hotel and fought. And then we went home. and I decided one more time, I'll fix him. I was going to drink up the champagne. So he stormed upstairs to the bedroom. I went into the kitchen, got my champagne glass. You just do not drink champagne out of Tupperware. That's just not cool. Poured myself a glass of champagne, took a couple of sips, thought the stuff tasted nasty, poured the rest of it down the sink. I'm sorry, alcoholics. Strategically placed the bottle and the glass on the table so he would think that I drank it and passed out. The only requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous is a desire to stop drinking. Trust me, I had no desire to drink. I went to AA meetings. I said, hi, my name is Valerie, and I have an addictive personality, and they let me do that. In Georgia, they celebrate sobriety with the chip system. I got up to 3 months sobriety before they realized I needed to be in the other room. I did finally get to Al-Anon. And I felt the very same things there that I felt in AA, the love and the acceptance. And I was bound and determined to stay. I went to 8 meetings a week for 3 years running. I had 2 small children with me at the time, too young for Alateen, but they went with me anyway. I sometimes traveled 30 miles to get to a meeting, and I lived in a metropolitan area that had meetings all over the city. I have no sympathy for people who say I can't go to a meeting because my kids are small or because I'm too far. It depends on how sick and tired you are of being sick and tired. It depends on how much you love yourself to take care of yourself. But anyway, I got into these meetings, and I sat around and I watched people share. Now here's where my chameleonism comes back in. I wanted to be accepted by you. I wanted you to love me. I wanted to be a part of you. So I did what I did best. I sat in meetings. I watched people share. I watched what got the amen nods, and you know those nods when somebody says the right thing and everybody goes, amen. And I stored it. I bought all of the literature that was for sale, and I read it. I memorized the open and closing by heart and the 12 steps and 12 traditions. I got all the pamphlets that we had. I was ready. Within a few months, I sound like I'd been in the program from the day it was born. And a lot of people let me do that. But you see, my insides didn't match my outsides. I was doing all the things you told me to do. I was going to meetings. I got a sponsor. Well, that's not completely true. This is an honest program. When I first went to my very first meeting, they gave me a sponsor. I would like to think that was because they realized I had a need. But actually, that group, it was their policy that when a newcomer walked in, they had a sponsor appointed to them. But I had a sponsor. I went to meetings. I was trying to talk to the God of my understanding, but we weren't communicating real well, and I'll explain that a little later. I was doing all the things that I thought you told me to do or that I thought I heard you say, but I wasn't feeling the recovery in my life. I was sitting at a meeting one night, and we had a topic going around, and I was pondering on what I was going to share. I wasn't listening to what you had to say. It wasn't important. I know none of you have done that, and because I knew how much you love to hear me share, because you told me so all the time. I don't have any problems with ego, I just have a very small one. And it came around time for me to share, and I was just about to dazzle you with my pearls of wisdom when this lady said to me, Valerie, I say this with love. Be very careful of any Al-Anon who prefaces a statement like that. She said, I say this with love. Take the cotton out of your ears and stuff it in your mouth.
Now, I am not a religious person, and I am not a fighter, I am a runner, but I thought to myself, how dare she?
She doesn't know who she's talking to. These people love to hear me share. I'm going to fix her. You know how we get when we don't fix somebody. Every meeting that I go to, she goes to, and the Lord knows there's a lot of them. I'm not going to share. And then everybody was going to wonder why I was so quiet, and I was going to look at her. Well, sometimes God has to get my attention any way he can, and he sent her. I hated that heifer. So I asked her to be my sponsor. My sponsor very long. God really put her in my life to get my attention. He really did. That was her sole purpose. And that's fine. That's okay. We're still good friends today. I did finally get a sponsor and of my own and started trying to do the things that I saw you talk about. You see, when I shut my mouth, somehow or another these two things on the side of my head opened up and started hearing things that I'd never heard before. And of course, me being as sick as I was, and thank God I got a sponsor, my sponsor told me, you see all the slogans in our book, do all of them but one. That's the one that says, think, don't do that one. You don't know how to do that one yet. She also told me, you know all those books you bought, don't touch them. The only one I want you to touch is the one day at a time because you don't know how to handle the information you've been getting. Because you see, what I did was I took the things that you wrote and interpreted them by my past living. And we know that don't work. My best thinking is what got me here. When you talked about detachment, I thought you meant divorce. They both start with a D. When you told me that I had rights, right to be right to be wrong, the right to be, I went home and told that to my husband very early in the program. He said, the hell you say? And I went, honey, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. They were brainwashing me. I don't know about you, but backhands don't feel good to me either. I wanted what you had, and I was willing to go to any lengths to get it. I started working the steps to the best of my ability, and my sponsor was very instrumental in that. My sponsor was very, very strong in service work, and she sponsored me that way. I talked to you about a God. I didn't communicate with God because I had a God that I feared. I had a punishing God like most of us did coming up, the fire and brimstone God, the God that takes notes on everything we do, that puts black marks by your name whenever you do something that displeases him, and Lord knows I did a lot of things to displease him. I did not take the actions that a child of God would have taken, and I feared God. When we got to that step that says, turn my will and my life over to the care of God, I didn't see the as we understood him. And I felt like if I gave God permission to take over my life, I was going to wind up in Africa, motherland, and I wasn't ready to go there. I thought he was going to punish me for everything. I thought I had to give God permission to get me. I don't have an ego problem. And someone pointed out to me that step says, the God of your understanding. Make a list of the characteristics you want to see in your God. And I did. I made a little list, and I'm going to share some of them with you right quickly. He was loving, he's kind, he's forgiving, he's powerful, he's all-knowing. This one I had to have. He's permissive. He's fatherly, he has a sense of humor. I'm about to strike that one because he hasn't been real funny lately. He's caring, he's understanding, he loves me no matter what. I had a few other things on that list, but I couldn't find my original list to share with you. And it said, Valerie, that's your God. Well, that's too simple. This is a simple program. I could turn my will and my life over to someone that loved me no matter what. I could turn my will and my life over to someone that I knew wanted only the best for me, wanted me to be happy, joyous, and free. I could turn my will and my life over to a being that would take care of me in all situations. I did my fourth step, and I don't know about you, but my first fourth step was very fearful and immoral because I shared everything that I'd ever done, ever thought about doing. And I thought my sponsor was going to throw me out of her house, but she put her arms around me. She shared her experience, strength, and hope with me. And she said one very important sentence: "You don't have to live that way anymore." I don't know about you, but a burden came off my shoulders. Now, it didn't make me free. It didn't make me totally free, but I felt lighter. I thought that once I was in Al-Anon, that all my problems would go away. I would never hurt anymore. I would never be angry anymore. I would never feel guilt anymore. I would never feel pain anymore. I thought I had to go to meetings with a smile on my face and a song in my heart all the time. And I didn't feel that way all the time. And when I didn't feel that way, I thought I wasn't working a program. And it scared me. I didn't want to go back to where I was. I wanted to be like you. I didn't understand who you were. I know now. You love me just where I am, no matter what. What a gift. I came into these rooms thinking that I was always wrong. I had somebody telling me that all the time. You're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. Even when you're right, you're wrong. And I had someone share in a meeting, you know, Valerie, even a broken watch is right 2 times a day. Can't be wrong all the time. Things like that helped me. I got active in service work. I started feeling good about myself. I did an amends with my paternal grandmother after I'd been in the program, maybe a little less than a year. And of course, to me, an amends meant I tell you what you did to me and you apologize. God takes whatever I give him and he uses it. I went to her and we talked for a long time. And we healed some wounds and we mended some bridges. And about a few months later, my grandmother was called home to meet her maker. You know what? I got a phone call. It told me to get down to the hospital as quickly as possible. But guess what? Death in this program is a heck of a lot different than death outside of this program. I had a God of my understanding. I had a chance to make amends to the woman that I love, my grandmother. I knew that when she passed, she knew that I loved her, and I knew that she loved me. I was at peace. I didn't feel abandoned. I didn't feel rejected. I didn't feel angry. I was able to go into her room, and she'd already passed by the time I got there. I was able to kiss her goodbye and tell her I love her one more time. My heart ached because I would not be able to physically touch her again. But my heart was full because I knew everything was okay. What a difference you make. A lot of my family is not in this program. And of course, you know how guilty we feel when someone dies and we feel like we haven't done everything we're supposed to do. And they were hurting. They were hurting bad. And because of the gifts you gave me, because you taught me how to understand and to love, I was able to pass that on to my family members who were hurting so bad and give them a little bit of peace in a time of sorrow. You gave that to me. My mother and I have made amends to each other. And like I said, my mom's my best friend today. We work on computers together. Mom always crashes hers and calls me and goes, "What do I do now?" And I go, "Mother." We share a lot of things together. My mom doesn't feel like she needs this program. She feels like she's too old to learn. She came to a meeting one time with me where I was speaking, and when I finished talking, I looked at my mom and tears were just running down her eyes, and I went, "Oh God, I'm in trouble now." And after the meeting, she came up to me and she hugged me the biggest hug I've ever gotten from her in my entire life. And she said, You don't know how long I've waited for you to grow up. You don't know how long and how hard I've been trying to tell you just how beautiful you are, just how wonderful you are, and how so very proud of you I am. She doesn't know what you did for her daughter, but she's very grateful. And like I said, she doesn't feel like she can learn anything at this late stage in the game. So you don't have to tell people you're an Al-Anon to carry the message. I share the tools of the program with my mom. My mom's learned words like detachment. She doesn't know where that came from. Let go and let God, one day at a time. This too shall pass. She doesn't know where that came from. It's not in any law book she's ever read. By the way, she is a lawyer. But she's using the principles of the program without ever having stepped foot in a meeting. We are a very powerful program. My kids, I have two. I have a boy and a girl. My son is the eldest. He's 22. He's, I think, in the Navy in Norfolk, Virginia. Up until about maybe 2 weeks ago, he was a special guest of the city of Norfolk. The one where they check you in and you can't check out. My kids were exposed to Alateen. And this son of mine, I love him very much, but I have to let go of him. And you taught me how to do that. He feels like he has all the answers. And I have to let him find his answers without interfering. And what helps me to do that is when I worked on myself, when I saw the things that I did to me to put me in the places that I got to, and I also saw that something got me out of a lot of situations that no human power could have gotten me out of, when I realized that God was doing for me even then when I didn't ask him what I could not do for myself, I have no problems turning my son over to that higher power, none whatsoever, because he's in good hands. I have a daughter that's 21. She's my best friend. She's the apple of my eye. We are running buddies. When we go out together to the movies or whatever, people look at us and think we're sisters. I think it's wonderful. She's not too happy about it, but I think it's great. This baby girl of mine wanted to finish school, wanted to continue her education, and she knew that her parents didn't have the money to send her to college. She knew that alcoholism destroyed our family, and we didn't know to prepare for things like that because we were too busy trying to stay ahead of a disease that you couldn't stay ahead of. So she got herself a job right after she got out of high school working for IHOP. I don't know if you have them here. They're International House of Pancakes. And she put herself through school. She's still in school now. She's been promoted to assistant manager of the IHOP. She's been working for that company about 3 years. She's a beautiful young lady. And I love her very much. I have one kid that God has blessed me with that gives me no trouble to date. And I have another kid that's my opportunity for growth. And that's the way I look at it. None of my kids are bad. I've learned in this program that I don't have to be afraid anymore. I'm learning in this program that I'm okay. I may not be perfect, but I'm okay. I'm learning in this program that I can make choices. I used to be afraid of making choices because I was afraid that if I made the wrong one, that bad things would happen to me. What I have learned and what I am learning is that when I work my program to the best of my ability, whatever choice I make, the God of my understanding is going to take that and make the very best out of it. So I have nothing to fear. I've learned that I don't look for you to complete me. It is not your responsibility nor your place to make me whole, to make me happy, to make me sad, to make me angry, to make me joyous. When God made us, He put everything we needed in the package. Al-Anon taught me how to tap into the package. I am fully self-supporting. I need you to help me get there, to show me the ways, but I have to do the legwork. You've given me me, and I trade with no one. My husband and I are still married. September the 1st of this year, we will be married 23 years if I don't kill him first. We are best friends, we are lovers, we are husband and wife. We can talk to each other. This program does not guarantee that a marriage will stay together, nor does it guarantee that it will bust up. The only thing Al-Anon, AA, and Alateen guarantee us is that if we work it to the best of our ability, we will have a happier life. That's all. You people are my lifeline. I am a reflection of you when I work my program. Because you took time out of your life to share with me your experience, strength, and hope. You held my hand and you walked with me when I was unable to walk. You loved me when I could not love myself. You taught me how to love myself, to be okay with me, to be at peace with me. If I'm a miracle, so are you. And I truly believe I'm a miracle. I'm going to close because I know you guys want to get out of here. I could really talk all night. I love this program with all my heart and soul. I was asked to share at my area assembly some years back when I had first gotten into service work, and I was not where I am today, but I was not where I used to be. And I was feeling a little apprehensive. I was afraid. I didn't know what I was going to share. I didn't think I had anything to share. And I was trying to figure out a way to backpedal out of this. Again, my commitment thing was kicking in. And I got down on my knees in my favorite place, the bathroom. That seems to be a common goal with us. You know, the bathroom seems to be the holy temple. Anyway, I got down on my knees and I said, God, I don't know what to say to these people. I don't feel like I have anything to share. I feel so unworthy. I don't feel like maybe somebody made a mistake. Maybe it wasn't me they were really asking. And I gave myself a little silence to let God talk to me. And I truly believe He did talk to me that day, and I'm going to share with you what He told me. If you feel life's beat you at every turn and everything you touch goes bad, you're in the right place. If you hurt way down in your heart and soul for someone you love and all you get for that love is rejection, abuse, and misuse, you're in the right place. If you've tried everything there is to try to make life better for others but to no avail, you're in the right place. If your God hasn't done for you or by you all the things you feel you deserve, you're in the right place. If there's nothing in the world wrong with you, but it's the world that's wrong, you're in the right place. If you come into these rooms unlovable and can feel a sense of love and understanding, you're in the right place. When ego and pride have almost destroyed the person you are, and acceptance and guidance are the antidotes you need, you're in the right place. When you come in as a broken vessel, drowning, going down for the third time, and the people in these rooms become your lifeboat to sanity and peace of mind, you're in the right place. I came in just that way, and today I can feel hope, faith, joy, peace, sanity, support, freedom, and love. I know I'm in the right place. I love you all. Thank you for allowing me to share.